So, without a hint of hesitation, the golem placed her hands upon the steel box and invoked her only active artificer skill.
Upgrade!
The charge pack shook and rattled quietly in Fizzy's grip for a second, and then it was over. Your upgrade was a major success. Custom electric charge pack durability increased by 5%. Custom electric charge pack power output increased by 10%.
All right!
She cheered.
Nice one, Fizzy!
Plus echoed her sentiment. Eager to see exactly what upgrade had done, the golem used metallopathy to probe the device's interior. The ability only allowed her to sense the metal parts, but that was still most of them. Through it, Fizzy confirmed that two major changes had indeed taken place. First, the spots where the various components were welded together had become seamless. It was as if the whole thing was cast from a single lump of metal. Secondly, the magical circuit Fizzy had etched into that bronze half-tube had been slightly reconfigured. The golem studied the latter one in greater detail. The overall pattern of the mana-conductive material etched into the magic-resistant metal was unchanged except for a few lines that were moved to form more efficient connections. This revelation pleasantly surprised her. Though it proved her work wasn't as flawless as she would have liked, it also showed where she could improve. The circuit's alterations followed the idea of path of least resistance to marginally increase its output without requiring more input. Fizzy was grateful for the hint, since she was still learning how to fully utilize those circuits. This insightful outcome was precisely why the artificer rarely hesitated to use the upgrade skill on her lesser creations. Upgrade. It is within an artificer's nature to tinker, whether for better or for worse. Requirements: Level 45 Artificer. Type: Active. Activation time: 2 seconds. Cost: 100 MP. Range: Touch. Effects: attempts to permanently improve any item of masterwork or lesser quality. This skill cannot be used twice on the same item. This skill can fail. Success rate depends on the level of this skill and the user's knowledge regarding the target of this skill. Unlike an enchantment imbuing an object with magic, upgrade attempted to improve an item's properties by optimizing small yet important aspects of its construction. It could be used on all sorts of things, including swords, armor, and tools, but it was ultimately an artificer skill that was most effective when used on gadgets and gizmos. Several other artisan jobs had similar abilities. For example, the blacksmith equivalent was reforge and the alchemist version was synthesize. Though they were available at different stages of their respective jobs, they all had the same basic function of magically scrambling an item's insides in the hope that it becomes better. However, these skills shared two major downsides. They could only be used once per object, and they could fail. The latter part was scarier, as it often led to defects rather than improvements. These flaws were sometimes permanent and impossible to fix. In the worst-case scenario, a failed attempt could lower an item's performance enough to downgrade its quality rating. This outcome's likelihood could be reduced, but never eliminated. Thus, most craftsmen limited the use of such skills to mass-produced items, and only the most confident among them dared to risk tarnishing a masterwork article. Confidence wasn't Fizzy's issue. In fact, some might say her overinflated opinion of herself was the golem's worst flaw. Regardless, even the self-absorbed construct recognized a magnificent stroke of luck when she saw one. Indeed, one couldn't call her upgrade's result anything else. Not only did it power up her new weapon, but it also gave her a helpful hint for future reference. The outcome was everything she could have hoped for, so Fizzy wasted no time in expressing her sincere gratitude to the god of...
Huh? Now that was just weird,
she muttered aloud.
What's the matter, Fizzy?
Plus inquired.
There was a weird buzzing in my head when I was wrapping up the prayer.
I didn't hear anything, though.
Oh, well... it was probably just Gunther being Urkel. Now then, where was I?
Having fulfilled her religious duties, the pious paladin grabbed the charge pack. She put it on like a backpack with the help of two rubber belts made of softened bouncewood bark. The black straps formed a cross right between her pleasantly rounded chest ornaments. She did a few experimental movements and maneuvers, but as expected, the pack barely budged from its spot. She had made it to perfectly fit her back without limiting her movements, after all.
All right, let's see how powerful this thing really is.
Yeah!
After hyping herself up a bit, the golem reached behind her waist and turned a small dial on the device's side with a trio of audible clicks. She went past the stun and shock settings and directly to vaporize. The charge pack buzzed loudly as high-voltage electricity ran across her frame. Fizzy stared at her fingers in wonderment, captivated by the bright blue arcs that jumped between them at random. This was also as intended. When she told Jesse earlier that she was making a charge pack for her weapon, she hadn't made it clear that she was referring to her impeccable frame. Honestly, she didn't even need that wrench considering her fists were just as deadly as any hammer, but she insisted on using the tool as a weapon. It gave her reach, leverage, and allowed for improvised projectile attacks when combined with magnetize. More importantly, it allowed the golem to avoid getting soiled by the squishy filth that tended to squirt out of crushed meat bags. Some of it invariably splattered on her, but it was a lot less than if she were to pummel stuff to pulp with her bare hands. Speaking of that wrench, Fizzy excitedly ran over to where the tool rested against the wall and grasped it by the handle. The high-voltage current enveloped it in an instant as she held it up to her face, causing even larger arcs of electricity to bounce between the lump of red steel and her forehead. She gave it a trial swing that produced a rather satisfying vroom sound. She then lightly tapped the smithy's floorboards. The spot where metal met wood emitted a small puff of smoke as a large, thorn-like scar instantaneously burned into it. Thankfully, Fizzy's outfit fared much better. Her Magmander-sourced equipment was nigh impervious to fire, and lightning was a similar enough elemental force that it barely did anything. Things would have been different if the electrical current running through the golem was magical in nature. Indeed, though magic was used to generate it, the energy itself was perfectly mundane. If that hadn't been the case, it would rip her clothes to shreds and cause damage to Fizzy herself. Even then, it wouldn't have caused much harm. Metal golems were naturally resistant to lightning since, unlike meatbags, they had no flesh to burn or hearts to stomp. Without a magical charge to interfere with the construct's internal mana circulation, an electrical current would simply run down the golem's highly conductive outer plating and dissipate into the ground. The only real danger the charge pack posed to Fizzy was that it could theoretically heat her up to the point of causing damage if left on vaporize for too long. With that in mind, the sparkling artificer turned the dial to stun. This setting would either incapacitate or seriously injure the average level 30 adventurer or soldier. Tougher meatbags would require repeated jolts to achieve a similar result. She could always turn the voltage back up if she felt it was necessary, but vaporize wasn't intended for prolonged use. Potential self-harm aside, the setting rapidly exhausted the charge pack's battery and could cause it to overheat and malfunction. As for the shock setting, that was intended to painfully prod people and potentially subdue non-combatants. Fizzy had zero intentions of ever using it, but put it in there since those were the three standard configurations for Arclight Artificer devices. The golem kept playing around with her creation for a while longer. She smiled broadly as she watched little blue arcs leap between her fingers, her wrench, and literally anything else in the smithy. Much like how that blonde gnome had a fetish for explosions, Fizzy had always been captivated by the unbridled fury and terrifying beauty of lightning. She always dreamt of having that sort of power at her fingertips, and she was overwhelmed to have finally turned it into a reality. Admittedly, this was a bit more literal than what she originally imagined, but she wasn't going to let a small technicality rain on her parade. As she idly swung her wrench through the air, however, Fizzy suddenly sensed a presence. She turned on reflex while swinging her charged weapon in a wide arc, stopping the electrified wrench mere millimeters from Kira's smug expression. The golem sighed and switched off her charge pack.
I really wish you'd stop testing me.
Fizzy frowned.
Good to see you haven't grown rusty while I was away.
The girl-shaped monster grinned.
Well, duh.
She rolled her eyes.
Mithril doesn't rust. So, how are things on your end?
Earlier that day, Boxy discreetly informed Fizzy that it would compare notes at a later time, so she more or less expected this visit. especially since it was past midnight and the vast majority of the camp was asleep. Of course, both Boxy and Drea kept an eye out for anyone who may have been eavesdropping. Since no such interlopers were around, the shapeshifter abbreviated the events of the past week, relaying them to its shiniest minion. It focused on matters related to its unexpected rank up to a hilt creeper and the meeting and subsequent interactions with Reggie. All of this happened while the monster shamelessly groped the irresistibly shiny and inappropriately happy golem. Admittedly, groping might have been too weak a word, as it was rubbing as much of Kira's slender proportions against those mithril plates as possible. Ideally, it would have given Fizzy a spit polish by licking every nook and cranny of hers at once, but that sort of thing was a bit too high profile. Besides, the former gnome was more than satisfied with the current level of attention. Towards the end of Boxy's explanation, the two of them had wound up on the ground. The paladin sat in what would have been Kira's lap if her legs weren't bending in weird places.
A secret doppelganger society, huh?
Fizzy idly remarked.
Have you learned how to tell them apart from other people yet?
Sort of. I can kind of unsmell them, but it's tricky.
The golem looked up at the wannabe catgirl's face with a somewhat puzzled look.
What in Rupert's left sandal does unsmell mean?
Plus shared her confusion, if her unspoken inquiry was any indication. However, Fizzy knew better than to openly question things that Boxy said. Trying to decipher that thing's inner thoughts was like attempting to measure the length of a sparrow by banging two rocks together. Not to mention, she was pretty certain she needed a working nose to unsmell something, which meant that she couldn't help single them out anyway.
So, are we going to crush them when we get back?
Fizzy moved the topic along.
We won't. They can do things that I can't. And the opposite is also true. So I've decided to cooperate with them, unless they try something stupid or fail to deliver on a deal.
Fair enough. What about this problem of theirs? Any idea what his deal is?
Not at all. I was hoping he'd be stationed at New Whitehall so I can spy on him. But it seems there's nobody called Jones Alexis here. I'll need to wait until after winter to handle him.
And you sure this Reggie guy will hold up his end of the bargain?
He already did, actually.
Boxy revealed.
I convinced him to pay me up front, so to speak.
Oh, so you made it past level 50 warlock?
Yep.
It was only natural that there were illegal job trainers selling their services to less than reputable individuals. However, Boxy was ignorant of the criminal underground's workings and lacked the connections necessary to take advantage of their services. Reggie was quite accommodating in that respect, though the younger shapeshifter had to pay that exorbitant training fee out of its own pocket.
Level 54, to be exact,
it added.
Had quite a bit of XP overflow from killing that VIP during the siege.
You mean the one you were saving for later? Did you absorb him yet?
Yes. Cadaver absorption actually succeeded on a valuable target for once. However, it got me a brand new skill at level 4.
Why do you seem so displeased by that? I thought that's what it was supposed to do in the first place, wasn't it?
Yeah, but it should target the dead guy's most developed skill. So how come it didn't go for the Ruin or Domination Mastery? Surely a VIP that old had at least one of them at level 25, right?
Fizzy crossed her arms and racked her brains. She understood the overall function and effects of cadaver absorption, but knew next to nothing about its specifics.
What do you mean by most developed? What's the exact wording?
Highest proficiency,
answered Boxy while gently stroking her rigid pigtails.
And this new skill was worth 10 attributes per level?
Yes, it was actually.
Well then, there you have it.
Fizzy smiled.
Have what?
If your status-sucking thing targets the skill with the highest amount of accumulated proficiency, then it's only natural it would go after a top-tier ability.
Though the golem had no idea which skill had been absorbed, she could infer plenty from the number of attributes it provided. There was a certain pattern to the rewards earned for advancing any enlightened job and its related skills. For starters, all job levels provided a total of 6 attribute points, at least 2 of which would go towards endurance if it was a combat-oriented profession. Skills available prior to reaching level 25, otherwise known as first tier, granted 4 attributes. This amount increased by 2 for each subsequent tier, 6 for the level 25 to level 50 ones, 8 for the level 50 to level 75 gap, and 10 for those above 75. Lastly, while irrelevant to the discussion at hand, all ultimate skills acquired at level 100 of a job provided a remarkable boost of 50 attribute points for their first and only level. In short, the ability Boxy acquired from the VIP Warlock's corpse was of the highest order despite its less-than-flashy effects. Ruinous Reach. The Warlock's inherently volatile magic gains some measure of stability. Requirements? Overridden. Type? Passive. Range? Self. Effects. Increases the range of all spells by 3% per level of this skill. Increases the range of ruin spells by an additional 12% per level of this skill. The shapeshifter already knew all that, and it certainly wasn't going to complain about receiving a free top-tier skill, especially one that provided such a straightforward and uncomplicated power boost. There were no dangerous downsides, confusing conditions, or situational shortcomings, which seemed to be a bit of a theme with most warlock skills. Boxy felt it was a pity it didn't absorb any of Arakawa Shinji's 100 warlock levels, but Ruinous Reach was a decent consolation prize. Its main issue with how cadaver absorption worked out was that the ability apparently didn't function exactly like Boxy thought it did. Fizzy seemed to have some idea what the problem was, but the shapeshifter had difficulty grasping her point.
Huh?
It asked dumbly.
Why would the tier matter?
You are aware that high-tier skills require significantly more proficiency to level up, right?
What? Really?
Yeah. That's what people say anyway.
But even if that were the case, the guy's mastery skills should have been at least level 25. Or close to it. How can that be less proficiency than a job skill that can't be more than level 10?
You're thinking about it the wrong way. That's like comparing 20 coin pouches to 10 treasure chests. There might be more of the former, but the latter can hold a lot more shinies. Understand?
Oh. Oh, I see.
An enlightened expression floated onto Kira's face.
So that's how it was. How come this is the first time I hear of this, though?
Because you didn't ask?
The golem guessed.
Good point.
The shapeshifter grumbled in defeat. The revelation regarding skills and proficiency was yet another one of those things that everybody knew, yet no one talked about. There was no way that Boxy, who was less than a year old and had been in active contact with civilization for only about 2 months, would have picked up all of that so-called public knowledge. It was starting to get a bit tired of constantly stumbling onto these tidbits. The shapeshifter really wished someone would write a book called Common Sense for Dummies. Then again, the only ones who'd need such a thing were monsters trying to blend in with society, so there probably wasn't much of a market for it.
Actually, Reggie might have a training pamphlet or something for new recruits, it mused.
In any event, Boxy mentally marked the case closed and resumed licking Fizzy's shoulders and armpits with tongues sticking out of Kira's palms.
How about you? What have you been up to?
It changed the subject.
I'm doing all the things you said, Boxy. I'm getting closer to the others and working hard on my levels, but it's been slow.
How slow?
Right now, I'm at 59 Artificer, 36 Paladin, and 33 Golem.
She mumbled warily. Fizzy reflexively braced herself as she admitted failure. She was told multiple times to get on Boxy's level, yet no matter how hard she tried, she didn't get any closer to catching up. If anything, the gap between them had been widening non-stop ever since her transformation. The shapeshifter's jobs and skills kept growing at an unprecedented rate because of the ridiculous amount of death and destruction it left in its wake. However, Fizzy took her inability to match such absurd progress quite personally. She felt like she was in a rut, constantly falling behind, and that no amount of skullcracking could fix that.
That's pretty good, actually,
Boxy commented. Much to her surprise.
So you're not mad at me?
She looked up at it.
I've come to realize I shouldn't be using myself as the standard. From what I've seen, you're definitely above average in terms of self-improvement. Besides, you'll get a chance to level up big time very soon.
Huh? What are you talking about?
I was told that, judging by incoming reports, the Empire's main force will attack the city within the next 2 or 3 days.
They're that close?
Fizzy blurted out.
When and how did they manage to advance so much in so little time?
The Imperial scouts that the Golem's team fought earlier should have been at least a week ahead of the main force.
I don't know. I just got here.
The shapeshifter shrugged.
I'll find out soon enough, though. They're sending the Sandman over to investigate tomorrow night.
But if they're that close to the city, then has spatial traffic already been cut off?
Not yet, but it will be by noon tomorrow.
An essential part of siege warfare was the prevention of teleportation magic via sigils and wards. Failing to do so allowed the enemy to completely bypass static defenses such as walls, turrets, and traps. Denying that was important, even if it meant cutting off an easy and safe escape route for the defenders. One could argue that New Whitehall's Forest Gate might fulfill that role, but that was scheduled to be dismantled in 2 days. The Republic couldn't risk Tol Saroth's magnum opus falling into the Empire's hands for fear that they would reverse-engineer it. That would be a disaster of such severity that it would make the calamity of Mona Tal look like a minor incident.
Then isn't Jessie stranded here? Her life is going to be in danger if they don't get her out right now.
Boxy eyed the Golem up and down as if what she just said was heresy.
And just why would you care about an insignificant thing like that?
It asked, its voice full of contempt.
Besides, the Republic are going to evacuate the non-combatants no matter what.
Yeah, but you could make sure she catches the last portal headed out of town before the Forest Gate goes down.
I could pull some strings, yes. And I suppose doing so would make her feel indebted to me, which I can take advantage of if I visit Horkensaft.
Boxy felt confident it would have to travel to the gnome's homeland eventually, if for no other reason than to specialize as a fire spitter artificer whenever the job hit level 50. The people in that kingdom were far less welcoming towards outsiders than the Republic, so having a connection to someone on the inside would be a huge help.
Nah, she can't help with that,
claimed the shiny in its lap.
That girl is a nobody. Knowing her wouldn't give you or me any leeway in that country.
But if she has no value, why would I waste my time looking after her?
As a personal favor to me?
Fizzy smiled expectantly.
But why, though?
It pressed.
It's complicated. Look, I just want to make sure she safely gets away from the city.
Boxy wasn't quite sure why Fizzy's interest in that girl made it feel so strangely irritated. Just what was this untasty feeling? Was it perhaps suspicion? It was most likely wary of betrayal. Yes, that seemed to be the case. The shapeshifter wasn't exactly the trusting type. Actually, that was a gross understatement. Boxy was so inherently distrustful that it assumed that everyone it ever spoke to could turn against it at a moment's notice. Corny Fizzlesprocket had done so once before, with near-fatal consequences. Perhaps Boxy's instincts took the Golem's unfounded interest in Jessie as a sign that her original, far less agreeable self was about to resurface. That didn't seem quite right. But the shapeshifter decided to roll with this assumption until it had a bit more information.
Elaborate on that,
it demanded.
Fine,
the paladin groaned.
She reminds me too much of my past self. So much so that she's unbearably pitiful. I talked things over with Plus, and we decided we'd like to get her out of here safely, for our own peace of mind.
Much like Fizzy said, it was a complicated matter made all the more convoluted by the nostalgic voice in her head.
Plus?
Boxy blinked in confusion.
Your parallel entity or whatever?
Yeah, she really likes that meatbag for some reason.
Oh.
No, I'm not going to say that,
Fizzy snapped to her left.
Because it's retarded! We've been over this! No. No! No! Yeah? Oh, right. Almost forgot about that.
Having finished sorting things out in her head, the Golem once more looked to Boxy.
Plus says she'll take the oath of arms to serve you unconditionally if you do her this favor.
Oh, yeah, okay. Works for me.
For some reason, that decision was much easier to make once it became clear that Fizzy's alter ego was the one that actually gave a crap about Jessie. That and the shapeshifter would be getting something for its trouble. If Plus truly was an independent entity within the Golem's mind, then ensuring that she couldn't actively plot against it was a desirable thing.
Also, she did prove unexpectedly useful earlier,
the Radiant Construct added.
She reminded me about something that might greatly benefit us both.
Oh? Do tell.
It's about a certain place in Horkensaft that has been locked up for almost a century. Rumors say the riches and secrets of the first artificer reside in that place. Even if that isn't the case, whoever manages to crack it open can earn a hefty bounty on behalf of the kingdom.
Uh-huh. Let me guess. It's hidden somewhere and nobody can find it.
Boxy had heard of plenty of similar stories, but even it wasn't childish enough to believe—
No, actually.
Fizzy interrupted its train of thought.
Everyone knows exactly where it is, but nobody has been able to get inside. That girl only mentioned it in passing, but she made me realize something. As I am right now—
Fizzy tightened her fingers into fists and looked up at Kira's scrutinizing gaze with a face full of confidence and motivation.
As I am right now, there's a non-zero chance I might be able to open the vault beneath the mountain.
Boxy liked the sound of that. The last part especially. Just the word vault was enough to pique its interest. Unfortunately, as much as it wanted to check the place out, this wasn't a good time. The shapeshifter had its tentacles full with its military obligations. It couldn't afford to have Kira just vanish when a huge battle was coming. She would be branded a deserter, throwing weeks of hard work out the window. Plus, Boxy would miss out on a prime opportunity to kill and eat a whole lot of humans. Such things would have to wait until tomorrow.
Tell me more about this vault.
At the moment, Boxy's only concern was listening to its shiniest shiny talk about shinies.
Part 6.
The Sandman's heavily cloaked figure moved through the forest with dizzying speed. Though it seemed otherwise, the creature was not alone. Boxy had mobilized all of its familiars for the first time in a long while for this outing. It was on a reconnaissance mission on behalf of the Republic's armed forces, and it was shaping up to be a risky one. Thus, the shapeshifter brought along all the backup it could muster. Except for Fizzy, of course. Even if that golem had the enviable ability to simultaneously perform both martial and magical combat, her radiant countenance was ill-suited to covert actions. Cora was hardly a paragon of subtlety either. The towering, four-armed fiend stomped her way through the forest like a herd of rampaging bulls as she tried to keep up with her far more agile master. However, unlike the shiniest of shinies, arms was far less valuable and a lot more disposable. She was to serve as either a distraction or a sacrificial pawn, depending on how things developed. The bumbling buffoon was told to follow the rest from a half kilometer back to minimize the chances of her stampede giving away Boxy's position. Ideally, she'd just move quietly, but she was far too big and heavy to do that while also quickly navigating the uneven terrain and dense foliage. At least she stopped smashing up trees in her path because she thought that would be faster than going around them. Boxy honestly didn't know which was worse, that Arms came up with this ridiculous idea, or that it actually turned out to be true. Apparently, the shapeshifter's MP had reached a point where it gave the fiend enough power to just plow through trunks and boulders without breaking her stride. Nevertheless, she was ordered to stop doing that since it was far too conspicuous even by her standards. Thankfully, the other two demons were far more suited to the task at hand. Claws effortlessly leapt from tree to tree with unnatural grace and agility. She clearly had experience traversing dense forestry given how she occasionally launched sticky strings from her palms and used them to swing across gaps. Looking at her, Boxy could fully understand why stalker demons were banned from competing in the biannual Flora's Lava tournament. Far more impressive than the Spider Girl's mobility was her ability to remain unnoticed while traveling. Trying to spot her was as futile as noticing a shadow that slipped between moonbeams. The succubus undoubtedly had it the easiest. Zira didn't have to deal with the rainy woodlands terrain at all. All she had to do was soar far above the treetops and allow her cerulean skin and dark blue hair to blend in with the night sky. Boxy was always envious of how she could fly so effortlessly. It allowed her to keep up with both her master and her arachnid colleague, even though her agility and endurance attributes were so terrible. Cora was the complete opposite. Though she had a huge stride and monstrous stamina, these woods had too many obstacles for one of her stature. It would have been a completely different story if the terrain was flat and empty like the grassy, clattering plains around Fort Yimmin. There, she could simply outrun everyone through sheer athletic prowess. Unfortunately, that situation was entirely hypothetical, and the reality was she had to constantly deal with low-hanging branches, protruding rocks, small hills, and the occasional mud pit. She probably wouldn't have been able to match Boxy's pace at all if the shapeshifter wasn't constantly taking detours to chase after midnight snacks. It had already been a full day since it gorged itself on Ambrosia's cooking, and it hadn't eaten anything since. Things like deer, squirrels, and boars were enough to fill its stomach, but their flavor left much to be desired. That didn't mean that the forest critters Boxy came across were any less tasty than the ones it regularly feasted on before becoming a doppelganger. They just felt incredibly bland and unappetizing compared to Ambrosia's indescribably delicious cooking. The shapeshifter legitimately wondered whether that dryad was spoiling it a bit too much for its own good. Eating cuisine that made everything else worse by comparison could have some frustrating consequences in the long run. Admittedly, there was more to a meal than just flavor. Ripping meat apart, grinding bones into dust, and drinking up every last drop of blood were all enjoyable acts regardless of who or what Boxy devoured. Yet those lifeless dishes that didn't fight back were way better. The mere thought of those stuffed hearts and nectar and eyeball pudding was enough to make the monster leave a moist trail of drool across the rainy woodlands.
Master, are you thinking about that green sack of leaves and moss yet again?
Zira asked through the mind link.
Yes,
Boxy confirmed instantly.
I see.
The succubus had plenty of time for idle thoughts and observations while gliding through the air. As per usual, her attention was focused on her master, and seeing it unabashedly hunger for someone other than herself made her savagely jealous. Previously, Zira had always felt secure in her position as the tastiest among her master's minions. She was Boxy's number one snack, which brought her a significant amount of satisfaction. That walking calamity of a box could never return her twisted affections, so being its favorite thing was enough for Zira. The succubus was quietly thankful that the other demons were hardly competition. It was undeniable that Boxy classified Cora and Drea as tasty rather than not, but that was despite their actual flavor. Fizzy, on the other hand, had a captivating luster that even Zira had to acknowledge. If anyone deserved the position of her master's ornament, it was that golem. Yet despite her shininess, she was ultimately inedible. The succubus knew her beloved the longest and most intimately of all living things, so she knew for a fact that tastiness was before shininess on Boxy's priority list. Therefore, there was no way that Fizzy could truly compete with her. But that dryad was a direct threat to Zira's position as tastiest, even if it was through her dishes rather than her body. If Boxy somehow grew tired of the succubus's flavor, then the shapeshifter would no longer give its snack the violent attention that she truly desired. This worry was only exacerbated further by the fact that the two of them hadn't shared in a single session of snack time in almost 2 weeks. Realizing the bind she was in, Zira let out a mental sigh that was unintentionally transmitted to everyone else.
For fuck's sake, Comfort Brains,
Cora complained.
If you got something to say, just fucking say it. That's why I can't stand you conniving whores.
The obviously ticked-off fiend had also been feeling quite frustrated as of late. Not only had she gotten very few opportunities to come out and play with the succubus's insides, but even those few occasions had left her somewhat unsatisfied. While once seemingly insatiable, the blue slut seemed far less active during recent acts. Where before she would scream, wail, and pretend resist, these days, Zira just sort of stood there and took Cora's abuse without moving a muscle. The succubus still derived some pleasure from the act, given how she occasionally let out moans of twisted pleasure, but was for the most part quite inanimate. This was unacceptable to the rape-happy fiend. If that cocksleeve was just going to take her dicking as if she were a corpse or a toy, then it took a lot of the fun out of it. After all, the whole point of raping someone was having them struggle, scream, and beg as the fiend forced herself on them. In a way, The knowledge that a fiend was oppressing and abusing another was almost as important as genital stimulation, so not having an unwilling victim was a huge turnoff. Failing that, a willing participant was an agreeable substitute so long as they didn't act like a dead fish. As Cora had stated once before, she would gladly fuck anything with a pulse, and Zira's lifeless attitude as of late was enough to disqualify her.
If you're feeling pent up,
Drea piped up,
I can always try and give you a tit job.
You what?
Asked Cora in an incredulous tone.
It's just practice. You know, just in case.
Nuh-uh, not happening.
The flat denial injured the stalker's pride. Did that meathead even realize how much courage it took for her to make such an outrageous offer?
Why not? My boobs are just the right shape for it and everything.
I'm not saying you don't have a great pair of tits. I'm saying I'm not putting my cock anywhere near that mouth of yours. You'd probably bite it off the first chance you get.
So, you'd grow a new one?
That's not the point! Look, I need a wet, squirming hole to satisfy me. Like that silky one between your tight-ass cheeks.
No way! I can't possibly agree to something embarrassing like that!
Oh? Not even if the boss was the one asking?
The master? Well, it's not like I'd have a choice.
She dodged the question.
I bet you'd like it. I know your type. You're all shy and reserved, but one dick up the ass and your inner slut takes over right away.
That's not the case. Like, at all.
Stop it.
Boxy finally stepped in. The shapeshifter sighed inwardly. Ever since it had gotten the Soul Link skill, the telepathic link between itself and its minions had undergone a change, an evolution of sorts. Where before it could only converse with each demon individually, right now they could all communicate with each other at the same time. Initially, this seemed like a good thing since it allowed for a more efficient exchange of information between itself and its minions. However, these ongoing, pointless arguments over who was sticking their genitals where had steadily thinned its patience. Still, it had to agree with what Arms initially said. The cocky, know-it-all snack hadn't acted like herself at all as of late, which could be a problem further down the line. After all, a succubus without confidence was like a treasure chest without any actual treasure.
Snack, tell me why you've been acting so strange the past week,
it commanded. Zira didn't want to answer that question. Even if her pride as a demoness had long ago been shattered and dragged through the mud, along with her face, her pride as Boxy's favorite snack wouldn't let her admit her feelings of inferiority so easily. Unfortunately for her, keeping quiet was no longer an option as the contract did not allow her to subvert a direct order. Therefore, she took this chance to pour out all of her grievances.
It is because you no longer wish to feast on me, Master. That red buffoon tries, but my body and soul will not feel satisfied unless my one and only master thoroughly abuses and punishes me on a regular basis. I need to be torn limb from limb, completely dominated, and absolutely ravaged in every sense of the word by my master, or I'll just waste away into nothingness.
So it was about your perversions after all?
Of course, Master. I am your personal, hopelessly perverted slut after all,
she proudly admitted. Normally, the monster would instantly reject her depraved propositions, but for once it gave the matter some thought. Even if its minions were bound by contract, it was important to keep them well motivated. That way, they were more likely to go that extra step and take initiative in regards to fulfilling Boxy's will without being expressly ordered to do so. Fizzy was a lot like that too, which was partly why it agreed to her selfish request regarding that tiny woman named Jessie. However, that succubus had a more troublesome and inherently rebellious personality. Even claws and arms were straightforward by comparison. By that logic, it seemed fitting that acquiring her personal investment in Boxy schemes would require some special attention.
Fine. I'll add more snack time to my schedule, it decided.
Really?
Zira shouted into its mind.
Yes, really. I have been running out of ideas for shapeshifting practice anyway.
There was quite a way to go before it reached level 15 of the shapeshift skill, which was a necessary step toward its next rank up. Besides, Boxy wasn't particularly against the idea of intercourse. It just didn't have the biological drive to partake in the exhausting act. It had no qualms about performing it on the regular if it would serve a practical purpose by motivating its familiar. That way it was more of a chore than a pointless waste of time and energy. Last but not least, it was a chance to savor Snack's nostalgic and unique flavor every now and then. Doing so might help alleviate the issue of Ambrosia's food being far too tasty, on top of deriving some personal enjoyment. In short, it had something to gain and nothing to lose. It didn't even need to set aside time for the act. Boxy was always decent at multitasking, so it was confident it could plow Snack's insides while focusing its attention elsewhere. In fact, given her twisted personality, the succubus would probably get off harder if she knew she was being screwed as an afterthought.
All right, I'm gonna get completely violated. Who's gonna get boxied? That's right, this slut. Go, Zira, go, Zira, go, Zira, go, Zira.
As for the succubus, she was practically bursting with anticipation as she cheered herself on while spinning around in the air.
I can watch, right, Master?
Asked Claws timidly. I don't see why not.
Yes! I am grateful for this opportunity, my master.
As expected, pleasing the stalker was much simpler than dealing with Snack. After all, pandering to her voyeuristic desires required zero effort beyond saying yes every now and then. Her drive to contribute as much as possible while being as little of a burden to Boxy was also commendable. It was the sort of hard-working attitude that all professionals should aspire to. If only the last of the shapeshifter's familiars was as easy to appease.
Oh! Then can I? Actually, no, never mind.
Cora was going to ask about joining in on the romp, but changed her mind mid-sentence. The fiend almost forgot that her master was definitely not the submissive type, and she didn't particularly enjoy being on the receiving end of ass poundings.
You sure? Inquired Boxy.
Yes, very.
Whatever.
Zira laughed in an exaggerated manner.
What's the matter, Blockhead? The big bad cock on legs feeling intimidated? Feeling scared?
Of course not! I have no idea what you're talking about!
Cora blatantly deflected.
Come on. I have a feeling you'll like being filled to the brim for a change.
I would not!
Reporting that Cora Lintaprix is clearly lying through her teeth while shaking in her boots.
Drea interjected.
Why, you little... Get down here and say it to my face. I'll show you a thing or two about being filled up.
You'll have to catch me first, Flatfoot.
She answered bitingly.
I'll pass on that as well.
Zira chirped.
I have to keep myself... tight and juicy for Master's big, hard...
Cut the idle chatter!
Boxy shut them up once more.
Snack, I think I see some lights to the southwest. Can you see what it is?
The demonic trio sharpened their focus as they forged ahead through the pitch-black forest. They were headed to the Empire's staging camp, which reportedly sprang up literally overnight. One of the Republic's guerrilla units spotted it from a distance and reported its location via comm crystal, but the enemy's tight perimeter kept them from getting a closer look. The Imperials were clearly hiding something, but the Second Legion was wary of sending their own people on such a dangerous scouting mission. Having their troops captured and interrogated was too big of a risk. That was why they footed the bill to have the Sandman uncover the invaders' plans and, if possible, sabotage them.
I've spotted the enemy camp, Master,
Zira reported.
They're about 1.5 kilometers to our left.
The monstrous group altered its path as the succubus directed and slowed their pace to a crawl. Cora had no difficulty keeping up now, but was told to maintain the generous distance between herself and the rest. After all, Boxy could use stealth, Drea had the superior stalk skill, and Zira could rely on invisibility and her swift wings to avoid detection. The fiend, on the other hand, had neither the skills nor the inclination for such things. Boxy and its two other familiars silently approached the camp until they reached a large clearing. The base was at its center, but every pine tree in a 50-meter radius was gouged out of the ground. Not even stumps remained. What seemed to be a wide path was on the opposite side of the camp. However, Upon closer inspection, it was clear that it was more accurate to call it a highway. The Empire hadn't just navigated the terrain, but had completely flattened it. While it wasn't a paved road, the incredibly wide trail they left in their wake made it remarkably easy for land vehicles to ferry troops and supplies. The shapeshifter's mission had nothing to do with roads, though. Its business was with the war camp itself, but its perimeter was more secure than it anticipated. For starters, the Imperial forces had several 15-man units patrolling the area. Every soldier had some form of illumination on them, from simple lanterns to floating orbs of magical light. To make matters worse, all of them were on high alert, ready to spring into action at a moment's notice despite the ungodly late hour. Even if one were to slip past their vigilance, they'd still have to contend with the numerous ramparts, lookout towers, and wooden walls surrounding the camp itself. The Empire had no shortage of timber to work with, and had made full use of it to fortify their position. They even took precautions against long-distance observation of their base. Immediately beyond the inner perimeter was an enormous prismatic dome. This illusion spell created an opaque bubble that prevented anyone on the outside from seeing in. Prismatic domes were usually only big enough to hide a small team or maybe a single house. Creating one that stupidly big would have taken hundreds of level 40 or higher wizards working together through the synchronous chanting skill, which was entirely within the Imperial Army's capabilities. The Republic scouts that first saw the camp had already reported these security measures. However, the base was much closer to New Whitehall than it should have been. Either the local scouts had mistaken its relative position by 27 kilometers, or the Empire had moved their base forward that much in just one day. One was unlikely and the other improbable, but both explanations were possible. Boxy was inclined to believe the latter, since the ground the patrols treaded on seemed relatively untrampled. The shapeshifter started getting personally invested in this mission. It was deeply curious how the Empire had managed to make so much progress in so little time. The most likely explanation was that they used an enormous amount of manpower. This being the army, they certainly had plenty of strong hands available for such a task. However, forcing soldiers to flatten ground, unroot trees, and construct defenses would leave them exhausted and vulnerable to enemy attack. The Empire wasn't stupid enough to take such a huge risk against the Republic without having some kind of secret weapon on their side. The opportunistic scumbag that it was, Boxy was very eager to steal said secret weapon for itself, if at all possible. First, it had to get past the security perimeter. The prismatic dome was hardly an obstacle in that regard. Though the wall of ever-shifting colors blocked sight and sound, people and objects could pass through it unhindered. Furthermore, the audio-visual interference worked both ways, which was why the perimeter was established outside of it. It was also why Boxy didn't need to worry about anyone on the inside spotting its approach. In other words, it only had to think about bypassing the lookouts and patrols. That was easier said than done. The sentry units kept a distance of at least 10 meters between themselves and the tree line. If they were stupid enough to venture into the woods, Boxy could have ambushed someone and taken their place. Unfortunately, that wasn't the case. Any attempt to assault a patrol would be immediately spotted, resulting in a lethal response from the 12,000-strong Imperial Army inside the illusory bubble. Attempting to sneak past those patrols was just as likely to end badly. The area was so well lit and had so many eyes on it that no amount of stealth would help.
"Claws!" it called out. "Can you slip inside without alerting anyone?"
However, the arachnid demon's superior stock skill was different. It not only muffled sounds better than stealth, but also camouflaged the body to a certain extent.
"I don't think so, Master,"
the stalker replied.
"I can get past the patrols, but those palisades most likely have magical alarms on them."
"They do?"
"The Empire is quite zealous when it comes to their walls, Master. If they went so far as to put up that prismatic dome, there's no doubt in my mind they put up other countermeasures. Usually it's a combination of detect intruder, alarm, and counter-scrying."
"Right. Of course."
Boxy was subtly reminded of the city of Erosa. More specifically, the anti-infiltration magic they put on their walls following the calamity of Monatol. Anyone who tried to climb over them would trigger an audible and visible alarm, Back then, it bypassed those security measures by making use of an underground tunnel, but it couldn't use that method here. Digging took a lot of time, not to mention the Empire might have someone monitoring the ground for suspicious activity. So, if under wasn't an option, then how about over?
All right. I have an idea, Boxy decided. Snack, go straight up and gain as much altitude as you can. Make extra sure the enemy doesn't spot you.
As you will it, so it shall be.
Following her needlessly theatrical response, Zira cloaked herself with invisibility and quickly ascended in a spiral pattern.
Claws, you're with me. Arms, rendezvous at my position.
Rendezvous what?
Just come where I am, stupid.
Oh, sure, boss.
Boxy and Drea retreated back into the forest and met up with Cora, who easily found them thanks to their telepathic link. They proceeded a bit further into the woods until reaching a recently vacated bear den. It wasn't so much a cave as a large hole in the ground, but it would provide sufficient cover for the upcoming operation.
Arms, you're the anchor. You have permission to engage the enemy should they find you, but otherwise you're going to stay right here unless I say otherwise.
Guard duty again,
Cora groaned. Leaving the disgruntled fiend at the entrance, Boxy went inside the den, followed closely by Drea. It was quite cramped and barely tall enough to let both of them stand.
What now, master?
The spider demon was taken slightly by surprise when said master began quickly and efficiently undoing its Sandman disguise. Not only did it stow away the cloak, mask, and gauntlets obscuring its figure, but it even reverted back to its base hilt creeper form. It turned its faceless, elongated head towards the suddenly embarrassed stalker, staring at her through the yellow spheres that served as its natural eyes.
Claws, come here and hug me.
What?
Come on, tight as you can. That's an order, not a request.
I'm not quite ready for...
Despite her weak protests, Drea's body moved against her will as she walked over to where her master waited for her. Her clawed, carapace-covered arms wrapped themselves around the creature's shoulders, putting the two of them quite literally spider-face to non-face. The scythe-tipped appendages on her back closed in from either side, pulling their bodies even closer together while making sure they didn't dig into Boxy's back.
All right, this is good,
Boxy stated flatly. It said some other things, but the stalker could no longer hear its voice, mental or otherwise. Her current situation was far more intense than anything she had been through before, so her mind almost immediately went pink and fuzzy. Even if she was an accomplished killer and an efficient assassin, she was still a total rookie when it came to matters of intimacy. At first, she assumed that the weird attraction she felt towards her master was merely a side effect of meeting the star of the Boxy show, and that it would wane with time. However, her current circumstances made her rapidly reconsider that position. For one thing, having their, technically, naked bodies rub against each other like this sent unexpected shivers of excitement up and down her spine. If that wasn't enough stimulation for her, Boxy also wrapped its gangly arms around her lower back and pressed its forehead against hers while whispering something. Drea had no idea what it said, as the tight embrace alone was powerful enough to make her non-existent heart explode. In some corner of her racing mind, she managed to offer a brief thanks to Jordan for her summoning contract. There was no way an inherently shy creature like her could muster the courage to do something this daring otherwise. Of course, this wasn't the demon's first physical contact with her master. There was that one time Boxy sampled one of her legs to test her flavor before immediately spitting it out in disgust. Its reaction at the time hurt Drea somewhat, even if she knew it was coming. Her present feelings were completely removed from this past interaction. If she could compress her emotions into something halfway comprehensible, it would be in the shape of a single word. Tasty.
Familiar.
Just as her head was about to fill up with pink thoughts, her ears caught a somewhat audible word from Boxy's true voice. Before she could ponder its meaning, she was overcome with the unmistakable feeling of her surroundings warping and twisting around her. This was then immediately followed by the sensation of falling.
What?
Having finally torn her attention from the monster's featureless face, she glanced at the direction gravity was pulling them towards. Her compound eyes seemed ready to pop out of her face amidst the realization that she and Boxy were currently plummeting towards the ground like a pair of rocks. The emotionally overloaded stalker momentarily panicked and ended up clinging even harder to her master without realizing it.
Claws!
It addressed her sternly.
Yes, master?
You're to infiltrate the south end of the compound. I'll go in through the north.
Compound?
The stalker looked to the ground once more and realized that the Empire's camp was directly beneath them. The gears in her head clicked together as she realized that Boxy had used Transfamiliar to trade places with the group's only flyer. It also explained why the monster ordered Drea to embrace it like that. After all, even if it was possible to bring along an additional person with the Transfamiliar spell, the passenger could lose a limb or two unless they clung very tightly to the caster. Drea was slightly disappointed when she realized that the whole ordeal was nothing but a means to an end. She really should have known better, all things considered. Well, it wasn't all bad. At least she had something special to think about while experimenting with fondling her breasts later.
Information gathering is the priority. Do not engage in combat unless absolutely necessary.
Understood, Master.
With a firm grasp on her mission and newfound determination, the stalker regretfully yet hurriedly disentangled herself from Boxy. She ejected a large amount of white spider silk from her clawed hands and crudely weaved it between her back-mounted scythes. It was an old trick she had picked up from one of her seniors about 3 centuries ago. Within seconds, she was gliding gracefully through the air on her improvised wings. Boxy slipped into a more compact version of the Sandman disguise with 2 leathery wings of its own, achieving a similar result. The 2 man-eaters gradually drifted further apart as they descended towards opposite ends of the camp. Boxy reflexively braced itself for impact as it approached the prismatic dome's roof only to fall through unhindered. This made the shapeshifter feel a bit silly. It knew that the illusory bubble could not stop its descent, but that was in theory. Actually confronting the spell in person had filled it with a bit of anxiety. The worrisome notion that it had no idea what lay behind that magical veil certainly didn't help its nerves either. Once past the prismatic dome, the creature was momentarily blinded. This wasn't an effect of the spell, but a natural reaction as its senses adjusted to the ridiculously bright luminescence of the interior. Numerous torches, bonfires, and lamps lit up every corner of the camp, and the inner side of the illusory barrier reflected much of that light back at the ground. The resulting brightness was akin to 4 suns having a free-for-all wrestling match in the sky at high noon. After its eyesight adjusted, the creature got a better view of the camp below. It was surprised to see that not a single one out of 12,000 soldiers were sleeping. At least that was how it seemed, given the sheer amount of people on the ground. Some were sparring, doing drills, checking their equipment, or performing some other productive act. However, more than half of the soldiers behaved as if their standing orders were to party hard. There was dancing, drinking, singing, and all-around merriment wherever Boxy looked, with almost none of the humans wearing arms or armor. For a moment, the shapeshifter thought it had stumbled onto the wrong place. Rather than a military camp, this looked like some kind of festival. People were celebrating so much that one would think they had already won the war. However, the heraldries and banners scattered around the place were clear signs that the place belonged to the Imperial Army. Even those symbols weren't proudly on display, but hung up sporadically as if an afterthought. Boxy might have failed to notice them altogether if it wasn't airborne.
Oh, crap!
The monster suddenly realized how exposed its position was. It expected the interior to be dimly lit, allowing it to covertly land in some dark corner. This wasn't the case, and anyone could spot it if they so much as looked up. Thinking quickly, Boxy retracted its bat-like wings and dove towards a medium-sized tent directly underneath. It deftly sliced open the canvas with a sword hand and impacted the ground with a heavy thud right in the middle of 3 very confused soldiers. The unarmed and unarmored men appeared to be in the middle of a heated game of dice, so the cloaked intruder's sudden arrival left them in stunned silence. The look of pure bewilderment on their faces lasted just long enough for Boxy's thick tentacles to wrap around each of their heads. The surprised men proved their training wasn't entirely for naught, as they instinctively grasped for their swords and blindly sliced at the fleshy appendages currently suffocating them. Although they managed to inflict a few wounds, it only took a few seconds for their skulls to start creaking from the intensity of the monster's grip. They managed to let out a few muffled screams of pain before their heads caved in and their bodies went limp. Mere moments after their struggles stopped struggling, a pair of off-duty soldiers barged into the tent to see what the commotion was about. They regretted this decision for the remaining 2 seconds of their lives.
"Well, that could have gone better," Boxy grumbled inwardly. "I should probably clean the place up a bit."
The monster discreetly disposed of all but one of the corpses using its gullet. The last body was used to fuel its broken reflection skill. Within seconds, the shapeshifter completely took on the deceased soldier's appearance and personality, as well as some short-term memories and final thoughts. Now wearing the skin of generic Imperial Soldier A, the creature left the quintuple homicide scene with a spring in its step. It didn't exactly have much to be cheerful about, but its ability had also absorbed a good amount of mirth from its victim.
"Infiltration successful," it reported telepathically. "Claws, what about you?"
"I landed in what seems to be a pen for monster tamers. Had to silence the squire that spotted me, along with a few noisy mounts. But I'm otherwise undetected."
"Can you hide the bodies?"
No. I ate the guy, but these things are a bit big for me."
It wasn't that she couldn't gobble up some horse-sized, twin-tailed wolf beasts, but doing so would take quite a bit of time.
"Hmm. Try and clean up any blood and arrange the bodies so it looks like they're sleeping."
"I will do my best, Master."
"Once you're done with that, seek out the commanding officer's tent and look for any documents, letters, maps, or any other souvenirs we can bring back to the FIB. We won't have much time before they realize something is amiss, so hop to it."
"At once, Master."
"Meanwhile, I'll work the crowd and see what I can learn. Arms, move a bit closer to the camp, but don't enter the perimeter. I need you to be ready in case I need a strategic diversion."
"So..."
Cora considered those orders.
"Does that mean I should get ready to skull-fuck me some pansies?"
Sure, I guess."
"Neat! What about me, Master?"
asked Zira expectantly.
"Start flying back to the city. We have a lot of ground to cover on the way back, and I'd rather not leave Kira's bunk empty for longer than I have to."
"Of course, Master. But what about the matter of my lonely pussy?"
"I'll handle your urges when I get the chance."
She moaned merrily.
"I'll be looking forward to it then. Please don't make me wait too long, okay?"
The succubus crawled out of the bear den she was holed up in and took flight, gliding gracefully through the night. Unlike the first trip, however, she was in a much better mood. At one point, she even began humming pleasantly out of anticipation. It wasn't the best idea, considering the covert nature of her master's ongoing operation, but realistically speaking, she wasn't in real danger of anyone noticing her presence from the ground. Well, except for the hapless Imperial scout who had a drop or two of Zira's anticipation land on his face. But luckily, he chose not to question the origin of that clear, sticky fluid. Part 7. The Empire's soldiers wasted no time playing games, sharing stories, and downing drinks as they actively blew off steam before the upcoming battle. Though their bodies felt full of energy despite several days of non-stop marching and manual labor, their minds were exhausted and stressed. Field officers fully understood that entering combat in such a state inevitably led to mistakes, most likely of the fatal variety. Thus, the ongoing lack of discipline was not only tolerated, but also encouraged. The leadership felt this forward camp was secure enough to afford an evening of entertainment to boost morale before the imminent attack on New Whitehall. 5 of the men were seated around a small campfire, heavily drunk, while one of them regaled the others with a tale of the time he lost his wedding ring.
"So when I finally woke up, I realized that the thing I locked in the cellar wasn't an angry bear, but my pissed-off wife!
The group shared in a brief but hearty round of laughter as the man wrapped up the anecdote.
But yeah, as I was saying, that's why you want to be careful when marrying a druid.
I always thought druids would make great mothers, though,
chimed in one of the others.
I mean, what with their nurturing nature and soothing personalities and whatnot.
Oh yeah, great mothers for sure. Even better wives. So long as they're not a feral one like mine.
Feral? What?
That's what they call some of them.
Someone else in the group chimed in.
Druids will change into beasties rather than waving them pretty lights around.
Well, how about that? First I hear that those tree huggers can... Wait, hold up. So, Ed's wife was a literal bear at the time?
Well, that's what I said, isn't it?
Exclaimed the troubled husband.
Well, more of a half-bear thing, but close enough for my drunken ass to not tell the difference.
Whew, Ed, I do not envy you.
It's not all bad. True, she has a bit of a temper, and her sense of humour flew south for the winter, and pretty much the rest of the year. Still, she's the finest woman I know. Really wild in the sack, too.
Oi! Lads! Stop that thing!
A sudden shout from one of the soldiers got the drunkard's attention. They turned their eyes in the direction he pointed, revealing a wagon loaded with wooden crates rolling down an inclined path between the rows of tents and shacks. It rapidly gained speed as it hurtled towards the temporary shelters with white and blue stripes, which stood out amidst the sea of beige canvas used by the grunts.
Oh, fuck.
The five men around the campfire rushed to intercept the runaway vehicle. Three of them grabbed it from the sides while the other two pushed it back from the front. It was heavy and had built up a fair bit of speed, yet the soldiers managed to stop it before it plowed into the officers' tents.
That was close.
One of them stated the obvious.
I'll say, that took a lot more effort than I was expecting.
Yeah, no wonder.
A third one joined in.
This thing's so overloaded with stuff, the brakes snapped clean in half.
He patted the side of the wagon where the lever-operated mechanism meant to keep the wheels from turning was clearly broken.
Those idiots from logistics again? Why, I ought to...
You ought to what, private?
The men instantly formed an orderly line and snapped to attention at the sound of the familiar, commanding yell. A slightly older soldier with a large fissure-like scar on his bald head menacingly paced towards them. He looked over the stiff troops, the formerly runaway vehicle, and the trio of extra-large tents before he turned his attention back to the men.
Not bad, maggots,
he said in a calm but stern voice.
Good to see you're not completely unaware of your surroundings. Now get that wagon out of here and find the one responsible for securing it. On the double.
Sir, yes, sir.
While the hard-ass sergeant organized a swift and efficient cleanup of the almost disaster, Drea was busy rooting through the striped tents. The stalker had been the one who sabotaged the wagon as a distraction so she could slip into the officers' quarters unnoticed. Their tents were in the middle of open, well-lit ground with people watching out for anyone wandering in or out of them. A direct approach was too risky, even for the stalker. Her solution was to discreetly and carefully prepare the overburdened wagon, sabotage its brakes, and send it careening downhill while she clung to its undercarriage. The guards would leap to stop it, providing an opening to slip under them. Unfortunately, it didn't work out like that since those drunkards unexpectedly intervened. Still, the clumsy way they stopped the rogue wagon kicked up a decent amount of dust and drew a lot of attention. The nimble demon took a chance and made a dash for the tents, using her back-mounted scythes to rip through both the canvas and any enchantments it might have had. Once inside, she glued the horizontal cut shut with a bit of webbing. She was rather surprised she pulled off the maneuver in only 2 seconds. She wasn't used to working with the high amount of dexterity and agility of the body Boxy had conjured for her. The borderline intoxicating power was, without a doubt, one of the perks of this particular contract. Another unexpected surprise was how easy it had been for Drea to find this place. She would have to be blind in all eight eyes to not notice the armed guards, the indulgent size of the tents, or the extremely conspicuous coloration of their canvas. It was so painfully obvious that the Empire might as well have put up a massive sign that read, "Super important people live here. Please come and murder them." In retrospect, the Stalker should have expected such foolishness from the conceited humans. Their obsession with pointless pageantry and needless showing off had been a mystery to her ever since she first stepped into the physical realm about 500 years ago. Even after all those centuries, the human race still hadn't learned that making their valuable personnel stand out so much only made it easier for assassins like Drea to do their jobs. The only thing the Empire did right was to split up the obvious targets into several enclaves of 2 to 4 tents each. The Stalker's point of view was rather flawed. Unlike most professional killers, she was an immortal demon, so her capture or death was at most a minor setback. It was much easier to take bold and risky moves when one didn't need worry about self-preservation. Even if she failed, she could merely be summoned again to have another try. In the past, Drea was contracted to several masters that kept sending her after the same high-profile target over and over. The idiots would often get upset with her continued failures, completely unaware that their own lack of power was to blame. The arachnid demoness had talent and experience, but these were meaningless when the vessel carrying them was woefully inadequate for the task at hand. That was why working for Boxy was so exhilarating. Rather than being constrained by her physical limits, Drea had more attributes and skills than she knew what to do with. More importantly, she could utilize them as she saw fit so long as she completed her objectives. Her only complaint was that none of the tasks she had been given were all that challenging. To put it bluntly, she was grossly overqualified for hunting down random civilians and information gathering. Still, she knew it couldn't last. That chest-brained shapeshifter would surely come up with some dastardly scheme that would put Drea's deadly skills to the test. Until then, she merely focused on finishing her current assignment with speed and precision. Unfortunately, she wasn't having much luck with the first tent. There were no documents, maps, memos, letters, or anything else that was important or even relevant to the war effort. The only thing that stood out was the suit of armor hanging from a stand in the back. Since none of the occupants' other belongings sparked interest, Drea decided to inspect it. The metal was an off-white color reminding her of Fizzy's mithril hide, though it lacked the golem's luster. Far more interesting, however, was the strong reaction she got from her detect magic skill.
"Master, I think I've found a VIP's quarters,"
she sent a telepathic report.
"There is no intel, but there is an enchanted custom-made suit of almost mithril armor."
"Almost mithril?"
"It's white, but nowhere near as shiny as Fizzy. I'm no expert, but if memory serves, human smiths are partial to creating alloys rather than working with pure metal."
"I see. So they diluted the shiny. That's a shame. What about the enchantments? Can you tell me what they are?"
"I'll check right now."
Verifying the properties of magic items was typically done in one of two ways: through a scribe's appraisal, or by putting them on and taking note of what effects they had on the status. Drea wasn't a scribe, nor could she equip the gear due to the huge claws poking out of her hands, feet, and back, but she had her own way of doing things. Stalker demons like her could quite literally taste magic, and Drea's palate was refined enough to let her differentiate between enchantments by flavor alone. Thus, she unabashedly slobbered all over those metal plates as she licked them top to bottom.
"All the pieces have been bestowed increased toughness,"
she announced.
"The breastplate has fire resistance and endurance enchantments. Strength and wisdom on the right gauntlet, agility and intelligence on the left. There's night vision and MP regeneration on the helmet. The leg plates improve HP regeneration and provide all-purpose magic resistance. The greaves reduce stamina consumption. All of them are quite potent."
"So, it may not be shiny, but it's definitely tasty, huh? Any distinguishing features?